From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Mormon Church has an interesting history with Native Americans. If you don't know the story, Latter-day Saints believe Indian people were a remnant of an Israelite family who made its way to the Americas more than 2,500 years ago. So Indians, they think, have the blood of Israel in their veins, but Mormons believed they needed to be redeemed. So they tried to convert them in those early years. It didn't really work, and a lot of their efforts eventually just dried up. But sometime after World War II, LDS church officials, one official in particular, started to focus on Native Americans again. The result was the Indian Student Placement Program. When it closed down in 2000, around 50,000 Native kids had been placed in Mormon homes. Today, we're using that program as a way of understanding the history and the conflicted relationship between Mormons and Native Americans. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's pretty easy to make a judgment about the Native American boarding school program in the late 19th century. Indian kids here in the U.S. were taken from their homes and families and sent to white Christian schools where they were forbidden to practice traditional beliefs or even look like Indians. But by most accounts, those schools were pretty brutal. But what would you say about a program where young Native American kids were shipped off to live with white people for 9 months out of the year to be educated and taught the values of a Christian church, only this time, in many of the cases, the parents of these kids wanted them to go, made a conscious choice? Does that change everything? Does it change anything? What about the identity of these kids? What about the constant effort of white people to force Native people to assimilate into a different culture? From 1947 to 2000, the LDS Church ran a program called the Indian Student Placement Program. Some 50,000 Native kids were placed in Mormon homes around the Intermountain West. The effort was to educate them and then to convert them. And this came out of Mormon theology, and it reveals a conflicted relationship, which we're going to talk about today. We're going to start with Matthew Garrett. Garrett is a professor of history at Bakersfield College in California. His research focuses on race and ethnicity in the American West. He has a book that we're going to be talking about. It's called Making Lamanites, Mormons, Native Americans, and the Indian Student Placement Program from 1947 to 2000. And we should mention that Garrett is an active member of the LDS Church. He's joining us today from a studio in Bakersfield. Professor Garrett, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I guess I want to begin with your own interest, not just in the Indian Student Placement Program, which we'll get to here in just a second. You've made a career of studying Native American issues and history. Why? What's your interest in it?
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles, and so I was in a very multicultural environment my whole life. And I went to college and was pulled into history where I could study a volume of people across time. And quickly, I learned that here in our own backyard, you know, as part of American history, there's a diverse groups of people. And so I just found myself drawn ever more towards Native American and European relations and how they engaged each other and how at times there's conflict and other times there's cooperation and under what circumstances and what sorts of changes, how their relationships evolve over time.
It's interesting. You write about how at first you weren't that interested in pursuing Mormon history as a subject.
Well, you know, you mentioned I'm an active Latter-day Saint, and so I grew up with that lineage and that history, and I was taught those same stories that many Latter-day Saints are taught, and they're fairly hagiographic. They venerate leaders and the good things that are faith-building. As I started to read into this a little bit more and learn about some of the hot topics that are being discussed, it became much more interesting to me. But it just seemed like this particular topic kept coming back to me. As a young adult, I was helping my folks out in the attic, and I discovered all these pictures. And at this point, I was deep into graduate study and studying Native American history, and I found all these photos of these brown skinned children in my family room, and I who are these kids? I was completely surprised by, and I start to learn that before I was born, my parents had participated in this program that I had not even known existed until I started graduate study.
Yeah, this Indian Student Placement Program. I wanted to ask you what your impressions of that program were when you started. I mentioned that most of our sort of popular impressions about boarding schools and education of Native kids off of a reservation are pretty negative. What did you think this story was going to be about when you first started?
Yeah, you know, I was coming from my training in Native American history that's very much focused on that side of the story. So I was expecting a lot of assimilation, a lot of colonization, and there definitely is plenty of that in the story. But I really was surprised by the choices students had to make. You know, I'm a big fan of looking at context and looking at what options Native American children, mostly Navajos, that was the largest tribe to participate, what were their alternatives and what choices did they have? And as you mentioned, they could go to a brutal boarding school. That was an option. Some of them stayed with their families, but they really struggled. There was a lot of poverty on the reservation in the early 20th century, and their options there, they struggled to feed their families sometimes. And then, of course, there was a lot of other issues with alcoholism and poverty that created another reason for people to want to look elsewhere. And so as that's going on, the tribe itself was trying to figure out what's the solution and how do we solve our problems. And the tribe started calling for more educational facilities, which in Indian history, we're always learning about how there's resistance, and there certainly is resistance, but sometimes there's cooperation.
This is one of the themes in the book, that while it's true that Indian student placement, this particular program, was in some ways a form of colonialism and in some ways a version of assimilation, but you also say that it cannot ignore or negate the agency of participants. They went into it, at least many of them, you think, eyes wide open.
But even still, I'm not sure they understood the full depth of what was awaiting them. But a lot of them, yeah, they wanted education. That was one of the driving forces. A lot of them wanted a cultural exposure that they knew they weren't going to get in boarding schools. They wanted to be in a suburban city where they could learn about white culture so they could be successful in that. I remember one student reported back that their parent told them to go on placement so that they could come back and get a job in an office building with air conditioning. And so there's a lot of, you know, agency there. At the same time, there's folks who really didn't know what they were signing up for. There's also stories in the book about missionaries sort of taking Navajos off for what they might have called a kitty dip, where they tell them they're going to go do an activity and they stop by a chapel and get baptized on the way. So there's definitely some misdirection. But at the same time, there are folks who signed up willingly who knew what they were getting into, sort of. Some of them are second and third generation whose parents had served, had participated. And so they had a pretty good idea of what was going to happen on placement. There's a variety of opinions. I guess maybe the best way to look at it is a spectrum. Yeah, there were definitely some who were, you know, upset and distraught and frustrated with the colonial attitude, with the loss of their language. And there were definite losses. And there were those who embraced it and thought it was wonderful. And now I'm a Lamanite and I'm so empowered and I'm educated. And there were probably quite a few in the middle somewhere that were trying to figure out what it means to them.
The relationship with Native Americans is embedded in the kind of the origin story of Mormonism. So there's this intense missionary zeal in those early days. That kind of passed into a dormancy for a time. Then it was revived, and it seems it's fallen away again. Does that about cover it, a kind of up and down kind of relationship with Native Americans?
Yeah, there seems to be a pendulum swinging, but you'll see the same exact pendulum movement in larger United States Indian policy, from moving towards assimilation, towards self-determination, towards assimilation, towards self-determination. So I think it's a relationship Native people might be familiar with, whether they're dealing with the church or the federal government.
Okay, the name of the book is Making Lamanites. What are Lamanites? Explain for the uninitiated in that.
Right. So Lamanites is a term that's derived from the name Laman, who is one of several characters in the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon claims to be the writings of ancient Israelites, refugees who fled the Middle East and came to the Americas and set up this large civilization that split in half, half following the descendants of Laban, the Lamanites, and the others following the descendants of Nephi, the Nephites. And finally culminating in this massive battle where the Lamanites wipe out the Nephites, and the Lamanites then become the precessors to our modern-day Native Americans, according to the introduction of the Book of Mormon.
DNA has now come to challenge that as a plausible scientific idea. So where has that left modern-day Mormons in terms of their relationship with Native Americans?
Yeah, so modern-day Mormons, I think there's, you know, there's the hard line traditional narrative, and then there's folks who are always looking for a little bit different explanation, perhaps. And the church has backed away a little bit from this idea that all Native Americans are Lamanites. Back in the 1960s, of course, it started as viewing really just Native Americans as Lamanites, but around the 60s, 70s, there was a movement to increasingly include Latin Americans and then Polynesians, and there was this larger notion of Lamanites by the 1970s and 80s. And then, more recently, just a few years ago, actually, those notable essays that the church has posted on its website, one of them about DNA in the Book of Mormon, starts to move the other direction and says, well, we realize that there's lots of other people in America, and they're not all Lamanites, and that, you know, that these Lamanites did come over, these people did come over, and they got absorbed to a larger gene pool, so that would explain your DNA. And, you know, so some Indians somewhere are Lamanites. It's sort of moving away from it, and I think, at least in the essay, though I think most Mormons wouldn't know that. So I think that's still the popular belief that all Native Americans are Lamanites. That's something that folks, you know, they're dealing with. And I think the notion Lamanites, even in the Book of Mormon, it's really a social construction identity. In the Book of Mormon itself, the literal biological descendants of Laman, well, they intermix with those of Nephi. And so you end up with this mixture of bloodlines. And ultimately, Lamanites become the ones who are not so much biologically, but more socially, behaviorally, fall into a particular group. And in the Book of Mormon, they're characterized as savages and backward and unspiritual. And that invokes, of course, a whole lot of interesting and difficult and controversial issues as well.
Joseph Smith, the Mormon founder, has these two big revelations that you write about, believe that there would be this big Indian gathering and that there would be this big Lamanite mission, that they would send people out to basically baptize as many Indians as they could. And it sounds like at this part of the program that Joseph Smith saw Native American people as potentially equals to whites. Am I overstating that?
I don't think so. I think you're right. I think that's something that disappears quickly. By the mid-1830s, it's moving away because the Indian mission failed. They didn't get new converts. But early on, you can see it in the Book of Mormon. You can see it in the writings and preachings of Parley P. Pratt and others, that there was this real hope and optimistic view that Native Americans and these European converts were going to come together and make something special. It was an inclusive, progressive idea. But it doesn't work. I mean, the Native Americans are not interested in this movement, this European movement. They don't want to play the role that's been given to them. And so with time, they start to fall away from the narrative. And it's still there in the Book of Mormon, but we don't talk about it as much. And that's what makes the placement program this thing where they're reaching back to this old ideology, and a lot of people got quite excited about.
But here's the thing that I think was really interesting. After it didn't work in those early days, Indians of that time, Joseph Smith's time, said, no, we're not really interested. You say that they reinterpreted then the roles of Native Americans and themselves as well, Mormons did. In other words, Mormons came to then see themselves as the elect, not the Indians anymore.
Right. So, of course, any Mormon today will be able to explain that they're part of the House of Israel, and they've believed that thoroughly. And that identity is something that seems to start showing up around the same time that Native Americans are no longer playing that role in that mid-1830s period. So as Indians are falling from this elect status and sort of becoming appendages, Mormons become the new gatekeepers for salvation, and they become the Israelites, and you start to get patriarchal blessings, and Mormons start to see themselves as Israel, as restored Israel, who can move forward without Indians if need be, and Indians are then moved to the secondary role from, you know, by the 1840s until 1940s.
This created, you say, a romanticized notion of Indians, and then sort of naturally gave way, you say, to these paternalistic policies of assimilation and conflict. Tell me what you mean by that. Are you saying that because Indians basically rejected their initial attempts to baptize them, that the Mormons started treating the Indians in the same horrible way that other American white people were treating Indians?
Maybe to an extent, but also because as Mormons moved west into Utah, they found themselves in immediate conflict and competition for resources.
Yeah.
And so that, I think, deeply affects the relationship between the two. And by that point, we're maybe a decade past this highlighting of Native Americans, and they're no longer the featured group. Also, you've got, over that past decade, thousands and thousands of new converts that are coming in from Europe and elsewhere who haven't been taught about the centrality of Native Americans. They weren't there in the first couple of years. The word Lamanite disappears from discourse and language. So it comes and it goes at times. And we, from the in 1840s on, it seems to have gone away a bit. There were still some programs and some outreach. There were some demonstration farms and some adoption and other programs. But mostly the Indian program to assimilate Indians sort of faded away after that 1840s.
I have to say, these demonstration farms, as you said, are fascinating in some ways. It's interesting, in Brigham Young's time, he operated these missions, you say, into Indian territory. You described they even had these kind of informal reservations, these demonstration farms. So it sounds like Brigham Young, it may have faded away, but he made a good faith attempt in some way to get along or deal with the quote-unquote Lamanites.
Yeah, but at the same time, there's war being waged against, you know, the Ute tribe, and
right.
There's,
right.
You know, there's the Walker
yeah,
War.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, there's this balancing act of, on one hand, trying to work with some, but at the other hand, pushing anyone off who's, you know, competing for resources.
Where these Indians went, okay, you talked about adoptions. There were also purchases where, and you mentioned in the book that Mormons did not want to buy Ute children or native children from others. I mean, they were being kidnapped. It sounds pretty horrible, but they ended up doing it just to protect these children in some cases. I guess the question is, what came of them? Did they come to be servants? Did they come to be seen as slaves? Were they adopted into households?
Yeah, there's a bit of a debate about that. So Ute traders and others would come into town having had a history of trading with the Spanish and others. They knew that white folks buy Indians. And so they would present them to the Mormons. And initially, the Mormons were reluctant. One of the early instances we know about where a man named Charlie Decker is presented a couple of Indians. And he says, no, of course, I'm not going to buy an Indian slave. And then the Ute traders proceeded to execute one of them in front of him. And at which point he felt obligated to save the life of the other and gave up, I think, a rifle for that child. So there they are, drawn into this trade. But it doesn't take long before Brigham Young and others see it as an opportunity to finally reach out and fulfill that missing element of the theology, that they could use these children that they're purchasing as vehicles to spread the gospel among the Lamanites. And maybe this is what the Book of Mormon meant all along, they think. And so there is this effort. And if you look closely at the records, you'll see that there's really a great discrepancy about how they were treated. There are some folks who seem to have adopted them, who seem to have loved them. But on the other hand, you have folks who list them on the census as servants, household servants. They are legally indentured servants. They're on a contract. There's a new book on Indian slavery that really identifies them more as slaves. So we can haggle back and forth of what that means. But I think the best solution is to just look at their actual experiences. And you really have these white Europeans trying to take in these Indian kids and often imposing their culture on them. They're colonizing them. They're stripping them of their native ways. There's definitely colonization.
You say that this wasn't only Mormons imposing their religious beliefs. You refer to this French term, habitus, which you describe as this cultural context through which these power relations, as you put it, are imprinted upon bodies. That sounds like a mouthful, but would you lay that out for me? What do you mean there?
Yeah, so it comes from this French sociologist, Bourdieu, who argues that your body becomes a way. You can be colonized and you can internalize, and your body, small acts that you take are all reflections of this context that's been pressed upon you. And so in subtle ways, you may not even recognize you're acting out and demonstrating what has been pressed upon you. And with that, we can look at these Indian children, whether we're talking about those who were adopted in the 1800s or those who were fostered in the 20th century, and wonder how much of their behavior is theirs, how much of it is imposed on them, how much do they even recognize is imposed on them. And it's a difficult to sort of pull apart and say, how much agency is really there? What do you do with this student who says, I'm a Lamanite? Are they really just dupes in a larger colonization program they don't understand? Or is that an authentic identity that we should recognize as such, even if it has some foreign elements that are inside them? That's part of the debate.
Matthew Garrett is with us. He's an historian, the author of the book Making Lamanites, Mormons, Native Americans, and the Indian Student Placement Program. We'll take a quick break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're looking at the complicated relationship between Latter-day Saints and Native Americans. And there's a fascinating history here, starting with LDS theology, which holds that Indians were descended from a lost tribe of Israel and then cursed for their wickedness. We're focusing, though, on another part of the history, the Indian Student Placement Program. This is in the 20th century, where some 50,000 Native American children left reservations in their homes and were placed in Mormon homes. Joining us is Matthew Garrett. He has a book called Making Lamanites. He's a professor of history at Bakersfield College in California. Let's get to the program. I guess it's crucial to say this was right after World War II that this program begins. And it marks a time, you write about, that Native Americans were looking for economic opportunities, looking to maybe not be as isolated, learn English. This is an important time for that.
Yeah, World War II really opened the eyes of Native Americans, especially Navajos, who had long been isolated because of the vastness of the reservation. And when World War II provided jobs and resource extraction, and it changed the reservation, a wage economy started to come in. And so people started to think, well, maybe we should look into this. And especially those who got jobs off the reservation during the war, they found those jobs disappearing after the war. But during the war, they saw something, and many of them thought maybe there's something to this. We have various tribal officials saying we need more schools. This white man's education, which Navajos had so long avoided, they hid from them. They would hide in the canyons when agents would come through to get children. Their opinions start to change, and now they're looking for the white man's education and the best kind that they can find.
So we need to talk about Spencer W. Kimball, really. He's a crucial figure in this student placement program. He was a Mormon apostle then at this time, and then he becomes president, of course, of the LDS Church. And he has a kind of affection, real fascination with Native Americans.
He does. You know, as a child, he was in Arizona, and he recounted watching, I think it was Apaches riding on the tops of trains as they passed through, and he had this fascination. And as a young man, he received his patriarchal blessing, which is a blessing Mormons receive that outlines some of your prophetic opportunities in life. And it said that he would work closely with Lamanites and help them. And so he was really anticipating this. And when he gets called to be an apostle, I think it's George Albert Smith that pulls him aside and says, look, I need you to work with the Lamanites. That's going to be your responsibility. I need you to help them out. There's these poor people that are hungry and they're desperate. And Kimball takes it upon himself to try to resolve economic poverty on the reservation. He writes articles that he publishes about poverty and struggles they're having, and tries to basically guilt Mormons in the world into helping these people who are in need. And as the assigned agent over Indian affairs for the church, he receives a letter from Golden Buchanan in Richfield, Utah in 1947 saying, hey, we've got this young girl. We're keeping her for the year for a foster child. Do you think this could be a program we could maybe expand in the church? And Spencer W. Kimball was excited about it. He shows up the next day in Richfield and says, yes, let's make this a program. We can't do it officially because the church isn't ready for it. The people aren't ready for it, but let's start bringing these kids in. And so you get the beginning of the foster care program as an unofficial, informal program. As Kimball continues to lobby the church leaders, he goes to their apostle meetings every week, and he brings public interest stories to try to persuade them. And he publishes in the articles of the church, and he's trying his best to get the apostles to agree that we should have some sort of program to help out Native Americans, specifically a foster care program.
It's interesting that there was some pushback from his colleagues on the Quorum of the Twelve. Mark E. Peterson was one. You tell this story about Peterson pretty vociferously, pounding the pulpit at some point, saying, this is not an official program, this Indian student placement program.
Right.
At least it wasn't then.
Yeah, one of the folks working for Kimball was a gentleman named Miles Jensen, And so Jensen would go out and hunt down children to bring into the program and invite them to participate and help move them around, and was getting this informal program moving. And he took directives directly from Kimball, and Kimball told Jensen that among the strategies to employ would be to get young children and placement children, these Indian kids who were in foster homes, white foster homes, Mormon homes, and put them on the front pew during their church meetings, especially during their conferences, and to arrange with the stake president to have them give prayers and to have them highly visible so that everyone would see these little brown children that are living up to white expectations. And of course, this is a definite example of assimilation colonization. And it was designed, though, to motivate Mormons to engage in this program, to get their pity and their support. And so as this is going on, people are feeling pressured to participate, to let some Indian kid into their home. And then Marquis Peterson arrives for a state conference. I think it was in San Pete, where people are asking him, do I need to do this? Am I supposed to take in an Indian child? And he finally gets up at the podium and says, you know, the people involved in this better clean off their doorsteps. This is not doctrine. This is not church policy. You better stop that now. And so there's this clash clearly between Peterson and Kimball and their different agendas. And I get the feeling from the meeting minutes of the Indian Committee, that they're waiting really for the right apostles to change over, to pass away, so they can get the right votes they need to pass this thing. It's interesting to watch the dynamics of the church leaders. You know, as a growing up Mormon, I was always taught and believed that that God talks and the apostles all hear the same message and they all are beautifully united. But the truth is, these are highly successful individual men who were in their own careers, and now they're in the same room together, and a bunch of alpha males trying to figure out what to do. Sometimes they disagree. And
yeah,
the placement program really reveals lots of this disagreement, both in the rise and in the fall of the program. You can see quite a bit of controversy between the leaders of the church.
Well, eventually it does become official. Peterson has to get on board, whether he likes it or not. And it's interesting, the part that he plays, or at least the twist in the story, is Spencer W. Kimball goes away on an assignment. Peterson's in charge of the program for a time, and he makes a kind of interesting change in the program. He says these students may be placed in Mormon homes, but they have to be baptized.
Right, which is interesting because, you know, you might look at this program as a proselyting tool, and it absolutely was. And I think maybe Peterson's thinking, to avoid that accusation, let's only deal with kids who are really Mormon kids. But in trying to create that situation, I think he ends up making it even more of a proselyting device, because now they know they've got to get people baptized to participate, and that becomes policy from that point on. Missionaries serving in the Southwest Indian Mission are using placement program and higher education and Christmas gifts and whatever else they can as a way to incentivize getting baptized. And so it becomes problematic that the placement program becomes a proselyting tool, when in fact, I suspect that was the opposite of the intent when it first started, but that is how it manifests.
It's hard to measure the effect on these young people's identity. In many cases, they made choices to do this. Their parents made these choices. In a lot of cases, as you point out, they had successful educations, came to successful careers. But what can you say about the effect it may have had on their cultural native identity, being placed for 9 months out of a year in a Mormon home in Richfield or some other city in Utah or the Intermountain West?
Yeah, absolutely devastating, right? Many of them said they lost their language. Others said they retained it, but many said they lost it. There are particular ceremonies and activities that are done throughout the year that are seasonal that they missed out on. Many of them in interviews have explained how frustrated they are that they don't know the stories. They don't know the ritual. They don't know what things mean, and they can't pass it on to their children. And there's a deep sense of loss that a lot of folks have. At the same time, others think that the education and other things offset that in a valuable way. And more likely, there's a lot in between who are both disturbed and also grateful. And that's a difficult thing to balance, and both of these deep emotional feelings.
It sounds like you're trying to make that balance. It seems difficult. On one hand, you can talk about how there were benefits, but then it seems a little heartbreaking, some of the negative consequences of all of this. There's a kind of a heart-wrenching story that you talked about, and others have too. Spencer Kimball, I think he was holding up photos of some of these Indian students and saying that the benefit of this Indian student placement program was noticeable in their physical appearance, that in some ways God was physically transforming them and making them white. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, yeah. At the 1960 General Conference of the Church, he stood at the podium and made a comment about the skin color getting lighter as a sign of civilization, which is a hail back to the Book of Mormon's original 1830 text that has that line about Native Americans or Lamanites becoming white and delightsome. And I'm not sure if that's necessarily what Joseph Smith meant. In fact, during his lifetime, he changed the text to say pure and delightsome. But that is what it was interpreted to mean as a biological racial change by many. And when Spencer Kimball says that at the podium, that definitely entrenches it in the mind of a generation or two ahead of mine that that was a change that would happen. And they believed that skin tone was connected to physics, to social manifestations of civilization, that the more civilized you were, the lighter your skin would be. And there's a great, there was an interview with a BYU professor of biology, which I imagine this poor gentleman stuck in the middle of, you know, theology and science and folks asking and challenging, you know, what is this? What is the truth of this? And having to explain to them that how biology really works. But it was something that folks in the church in the 1960s and 70s and maybe lingering on have tried to deal with.
So we were talking about this cycle in this story. How there was a missionary zeal at first. It goes dormant. It's revived. Now it seems to have gone dormant again. Although I have to say I was surprised to hear that this thing lasted until 2000. I didn't realize it had really lasted all of that long. But where is the idea now? Are we back in a dormancy that may be revived? Or now that all of this information we're getting about Indian DNA and the impossibility, or at least the extreme implausibility, that Native Americans were a remnant of this Israelite family is going to now change in significant ways the relationship between Mormons and Indians? What do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't dare say where I think it's going, but I can say where it's been. And from the 1980s, 90s on, it was in decline, and most people forgot the program existed. Like you said, they were surprised it lasted till 2000. But this idea of leaving the Indian program, it wasn't just placement program that went away, right? It was the Indian Seminary program. It was the BYU Indian program. It was the Southwest Indian Mission. There was a variety of programs that all started to just move away after the death of Spencer Kimball. And there's a variety of reasons. Mostly the correlation movement was trying to streamline and make everything systematic and common. And you know, individual programs that were special oddity programs had to be removed or otherwise integrated into the larger system for everyone. But as that happened, a lot of Native Americans were concerned. Interestingly, I think a lot of people who identified as Lamanites, who embraced the programs, who thought this was a wonderful opportunity, though that faction of people, they were disturbed to see that the church was leaving all these ideas behind. The church was walking away. And famously, George P. Lee, the Navajo who had served in the he was in the placement program. He went to BYU. He became a general authority. He started to have real problems with this. And he started to complain about this. And he started to complain to the apostles about abandoning these programs. And he outright criticized them, abandoning Spencer W. Kimball's vision that they were abandoning the Lamanites, that the Lamanites, according to the Book of Mormon and going back to that old theology, that they were special and they were entitled to special blessings and support, and they were going to be something, they were going to be powerful, and the church was turning its back on them. And that was very disturbing, I think, to probably a lot of folks trying to figure out what to make of this program that you might call assimilationist. But what do you deal with the folks who are loving it and that are Native Americans who embrace it? And now they don't want it to go away.
Yeah. And leaders excommunicated Lee.
Right. He was excommunicated in 1989.
Yeah. It's Matthew Garrett. He is an historian, author of the book Making Lamanites, Mormons, Native Americans in the Indian Student Placement Program. He joined us from a studio in Bakersfield. He's a professor of history at Bakersfield College. Professor Garrett, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the interesting and conflicted relationship between Latter-day Saints and Native Americans. We've been focusing on one particular program, the Indian Student Placement Program, that played out between 1947 and 2000. We had Professor Matthew Garrett with us before. Joining us now on the program is Elise Boxer, an assistant professor of history and a coordinator of Native American Studies at the University of South Dakota. She's been writing about the Indian Placement Program. She is working on a book about Mormonism and so-called Lamanite identity. It's going to be called To Become White and Delightsome. Boxer is an enrolled citizen of the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes. Also, we should say, is an active Latter-day Saint. She's traveling these days and joining us from a studio in Des Moines, Iowa. And Elise Boxer, welcome to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today.
I think I understand how your view may be somewhat different from Matthew Garrett's, but let's talk a little bit about maybe how you might see this story differently. And let me begin with something that he mentions in his book, that how your perspective is valuable, but I think he might be saying that it may be oversimplistic. Here's how he puts it in the book. He says, your work and the work of others who are extremely critical about this displacement program, he says, assumes a conflict-bound binary of colonizers and the colonized. How do you react to that? I guess we should start there.
Well, I'm not surprised. My work typically does get a lot of pushback from Mormons, largely Mormons, and typically largely white Mormons. And I think if you look at that particular citation in his book, particularly in the introduction, I think what he fails to understand is actually the theory and the framework that I use in my own work. So it is not binary. It's not conflict driven, but it's really looking at power. So the theory that I use and in my own work is looking at this idea of colonialism or colonization really from an indigenous perspective. So the work and the scholars that I cite are other indigenous scholars who understand the relationship between the colonizer and the colonized. So, for example, if we look at the work of Linda Tawai'i Smith, Decolonizing Methodologies, and then also in her book, I'll start with that. In her book, she, you know, talks about colonization really as, you know, a foreign system of power that penetrates and transforms the colonized society, whether that be through economics, whether that be, you know, religiously or spiritually. But that, I think, is what I'm looking at. And, you know, when we talk about this system between the colonizer and the colonized, we're looking at the colonizers who really are utilizing their power to not only define the other or the racialized other, and in this context, American Indian people or Lamanites, but it's also about the construction of that identity. And so I think that's what's significant about the framework and the theory that I utilize, is that talking about colonization and colonialism, specifically in the context of Mormons or the LDS Church, I'm looking at institutional aspects of that. How do they transform indigenous societies, indigenous ways of knowing, indigenous ways of being and living? And we really can't talk about the Indian Student Placement Program without talking about colonization. So I think it's significant that we begin our discussions with that.
It's interesting when you look at something that Matthew Garrett talks about, that a lot of these, you know, Native American kids had been sent away by their parents, who thought that they were going to get a good education, some economic opportunity. They came to these comfortable homes. And this is one of the questions you ask in your article. I imagine you're exploring it in your book. How did these American Indian kids, as you put it, negotiate their identity in these comfortable homes? And you quote this anthropologist, Ann Stoller, who called these places intimacies of empire. Would you work me through that, if you would? I find this really interesting. They're really comfortable, but it may not be to their benefit.
Right. So I'm going to kind of connect it back to the discussion that happened earlier in the half hour. So when we talk about like boarding schools, right, we're looking at that as like institutions, right? These schools, and whether they're on reservation or off reservation boarding schools, but that these Native children are going to, you know, these particular educational institutions and experiencing either assimilation, acculturation, or colonization in various different ways. The reason why I think that the Indian Student Placement Program hasn't necessarily been placed in that context is because it happens in the intimacy of a home. And I think when we talk about, like, in a sense, like this intimate sphere, right, we're talking about colonization that happens on a level that's far more nuanced than what we're going to see in educational institutions. So if you look at boarding schools in general, and specifically the boarding schools of like the 19th century, I mean, that's really the point. They were they're created after very like a military type style, really looking at that idea by Captain Richard Henry Pratt of kill the Indian, save the man. Now, that philosophy may looks very different in Mormon homes, but the processes are very similar. So when these Indian children are going to either boarding schools or to the home, you know, they are first taken to like to the LDS church, or what they call like the stake center, right? So they'll arrive, you know, they kind of go through a process of, you know, they like in a sense an intake process. And that's not any different than a boarding school where they arrive, you know, their hair gets cut, they're given a new name, they're given new clothes. And again, like in the sphere of the home, that happens very similarly. If you look at some of the stories, for example, by Helen John, the first girl who began, and I'm going to, instead of using that term unofficial, I'm going to use the term illegal, because that was not a sanctioned program. And you're transferring Native children from across interstate lines, and it wasn't official by the LDS Church. So this young girl, you know, is somebody that is part of a migrant family that's working in the fields. And ultimately, you know, they are trying to, in a sense, make her presentable to this Mormon family, you know. And, you know, they wash her hair, you know, they give her new clothing. And she begins, you know, the first, I would say, like, obviously the first individual, but ultimately ushers in this wave of what will become the Indian Student Placement Program. And so that the efforts then within the home, like I said, are done more on an intimate one-to-one basis. For the most part, you know, young girls are going to be taught different skills, right? Not unlike the boarding schools where they became, let's say, for example, people who learned how to sew, you know, vocational trades. And in the home, they were taught how to cook, how to clean, et cetera. So while it didn't happen in the boarding school, within the home, it did happen. But like I said, in very different ways. But I think also on that intimate level, it allows for this process of colonization or acculturation to happen. But it's just not perhaps maybe as traumatic. But for other students and participants, it was a very traumatic experience as they entered into these homes.
How did the Mormon Church get away with the Indian Placement Program after the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed in the, I think, late 1970s? That placement program continued. How did the Mormon Church get away with it after that?
That's what I call it, kind of like the Mormon exemption. So if you really look at the Indian Child Welfare Act, which was passed in 1978, you know, this piece of legislation is heralded as an affirmation of tribal sovereignty. For the first time, right, they're going to decide what is in the best interest of an Indian child. It reaffirms tribal court sovereignty, where tribal courts must be involved in this process. But this Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, was really in response to a large scale of removal of Native children from homes. So, for example, leading up to that 1978, they had congressional hearings, and they talk about that, whether through adoptions or through foster care, Indian children are still being removed. So when initially in the 19th century, it was boarding schools as a way to remove and to assimilate Native children, in the 20th century, it became, it continued. And you have a large-scale adoption and foster care in a lot of Native communities. For example, in South Dakota, on average, some reservations like Pine Ridge are as high as like 50% and higher of removal of Native children. You know, in Alaska Native communities, about 1 in 3 Native children are either being removed to foster care or being adopted out. So ICWA was a really a way to stop that removal of Indian children, and especially when they're being placed into non-Indian families. And by being placed into non-Indian families away from the reservation community, that is another way in which they're severing the ties that these Native children have to their families and to their tribal communities, and then ultimately as Native people as a whole. Now, it's interesting, if you look at ICWA and some of the hearings, you'll see the LDS Church really really an opponent of the passage of this legislation. Mm. And you have individuals like George P. Lee, who in a sense become the poster boy of the Indian Student Placement Program. And he becomes an advocate in behalf of the LDS Church and arguing, and this is why terminology becomes very important, right, is that ICWA was to stop really like the adoption and like foster care. They were trying to do away with the Indian Student Placement Program as part of that. And their argument and why it was ultimately effective is that it was a temporary foster care program. It was 9 months. It was something that parents had agreed to. But that's ultimately why they're able to, in a sense, be exempt from the ICWA. And, you know, you'll still see Indian children after 1978 because they're being adopted privately through LDS social services, where that continues.
How do you assess the damage that was done, do you think, to some of the 50,000 young people who were part of that program? Is that difficult to even measure?
I think it is difficult to measure, because what the literature reveals and the interviews that have been conducted thus far are those that are typically favorable to the Indian Student Placement Program, you know, and then those interviews, I think, especially those that were done by the Charles Rudd Center for Western Studies at Brigham Young University, what they ended up highlighting, and I think if you read them very carefully, and again, understand like in a very critical perspective, some of the experiences that they share, you'll see a lot of these young people experience racism within the LDS Church. And, you know, what we don't see oftentimes are those that, as a result of their participation in the LDS Church, choose not to remain members or active and practicing members of the LDS faith. And I think those are the voices that we really need to not only listen to, but to start to include in the literature, are those critical voices. And they are out there. But they tend to get silenced, and instead the focus is on, you know, that the students who were either success or that they made the best of that program. Yeah. And I think with in terms of like the cultural impact, that's really hard to quantify in any way. You'll see some students, for example, and people who participated who talk about how where I use that term internalized colonization, where they buy into that idea of a Lamanite identity, that by their conversion through Mormonism, that they ultimately are going to become white and delightsome, as if that is a better category in terms of looking at one's identity. And so you'll see Indian kids who literally are scrubbing their skin with like a Brillo pad in the hopes that they will become physically white like their foster family. Wow. You have others, you know, people recall how they feel more comfortable around whites versus their own people. Wow. And even within Native communities, you see these young people who are ostracized. You know, they're kind of caught in between two. They're not necessarily completely acceptable by some tribal communities or their own tribal communities, but they're never really accepted either in fully into the Mormon world. You know, it's what I would call an insider outsider. Yes, they grew up LDS, but ultimately they still remain an outsider because their experiences and their identity don't mesh with this larger Mormon identity that has a tendency to be grounded in a very American Utah-based identity.
You say in your article that the Lamanites, so-called, are glorified and condemned at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you, you often hear from Black or an African-American Latter-day Saints that they wish their church would officially repudiate some of these you know, old folk doctrines about black people somehow being fence sitters in heaven or cursed with the mark of Cain. I wonder, do you feel the same way about Native American issues, that there are some pretty dated ideas still in place in Mormonism, some pretty dated doctrines that are just racist and need to be changed?
Yes. And I think part of, you know, when we talk about race or racism within the LDS Church, it typically we frame those discussions as either black and white. What we tend to forget from that conversation is looking at indigenous people. I'll even include whether we're talking about Latino or Pacific Islander people, right? But we don't talk about that in that context. And, you know, the fact is that we look at what our leaders, you know, say during General Conference, right? So going back to that earlier discussion about Spencer W. Kimball, you know, as an apostle, then ultimately a prophet of the LDS Church, you know, membership takes what he says as fact. You know, I myself have been told that, you know, I don't know my history as a Dakota because I don't claim the Book of Mormon as my people's history, and that I should know that my people have always been a bloodthirsty people. We've always been a warfaring people, and that is found in the history of the Book of Mormon. And so I think when people don't repudiate those or even have a discussion and an understanding about how indigenous people fit into this conversation, that to me is problematic. But I think that has that also reflects, I think, just Mormon culture in general. You know, people look at Bruce R. McConkie, right, and they look at his book, Mormon Doctrine, as fact, despite the fact that later on in his life he said he wished he never wrote that. And so I think when we, you know, we can uphold the apostles and prophets of the LDS Church, but we must also realize that they are men, you know, and they're imperfect men. And I think until we can have some of these uncomfortable discussions, I don't think in terms of racism ceasing to exist in the LDS Church, are we going to get to that point? And to really move outside a really American Mormon identity and be inclusive of those that don't fit into that. The majority of LDS membership today resides outside of the United States, but we don't see that reflected in our leadership. Oftentimes we don't see that reflected at the pulpits, and we don't really see that reflected during General Conference either.
That's Elise Boxer. She teaches history and Native American studies at the University of South Dakota. She's working on a book to be called To Become White and Delightsome, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Construction of a Lamanite Identity. She joined us from a studio in Des Moines, Iowa. Elise Boxer, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark.